Welcome to the Fund the People podcast. I'm your host, Rusty Stahl. I'm president and CEO of Fund the People, where our mission is to maximize investment in America's nonprofit workforce. We give funders and nonprofits cutting-edge ideas, research, and tools to help drive equity, effectiveness, and endurance in the social sector. So let's start the show. Welcome to the Fund the People podcast. Thank you for being part of this community. Are you wondering how you can help reform the way your city, county, or state government contracts with nonprofits? Do you feel like you're just one overcommitted, tired nonprofit leader or just one modest-sized funder who can't make a difference on this massive issue? Well, this episode is part of our ongoing coverage of how government policies and practices impact the nonprofit workforce. And today, we'll explore a great current example of how modest-sized nonprofits and funders, just like you, can take concrete action to improve government contracting in your community. You'll hear the story of how Oregon's nonprofit community is advocating for improved government investment in the nonprofit workforce, how our two guests today are helping to lead and guide that effort, and how they helped to birth a task force on modernizing grant funding and contracting, which was established last year by the Oregon State Legislature. My incredible guests today are Felicita Montablanco, Public Affairs Manager at Northwest Health Foundation, and Mercedes Elizalde, Director of Advocacy at Latino Network and Board Member of the Nonprofit Association of Oregon. Thank you both for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah. And thanks for all your amazing work. I'm really excited to bring your guys' story to this podcast and to our listeners. I think people will find it super helpful. So before we dive into that story, I want to give people some context for who you are. So I always ask our guests to just give us a little bit of a window into your own careers and who you are. So if you wouldn't mind sharing a little bit of what motivated your nonprofit or social change career. Let's start with you, Mercedes.
Well, for me, the nonprofit sector really started when I was a kid and participating in programs that were run by nonprofit organizations in my community. Really just meeting these incredible caring adults who seemed to care about me for no good reason, who cared about my family and my success. These were some of the first people who I had met who told me that I should go to college, not just I should, but that I had to, and that I was capable. And I wanted to be them. I wanted to be people like them who took care of people in our community. So once I started working, actually my first kind of paid job was as a high school student tutoring middle school students in an education program. And it just kind of kept growing from there. I continued to work in youth development into my 20s. And then I started moving into supportive employment and housing case management, and then advocacy in direct service. I ended up getting a master's in nonprofit leadership from Seattle University, really essentially committing myself to the sector and to the work that we do. My focus in my field of study was advocacy for direct service nonprofits. I just see the work that we do as absolutely part of the fabric of what it is to be community. And to integrate advocacy in that is how we fuel our mission for the long term. So this is just the work that I love.
Awesome. Thank you for sharing that. How about yourself?
So I've only ever worked in this sector. These are my people. They're social justice oriented. They're so thoughtful, like me, a lot of type A's. I started in this sector out of college, working in event management and development, did that for 6 years, ended up going to a job that was focused on capacity building within the sector, really focused geographically on the community that I happen to live in. And as a direct result, I learned more and more about what was happening at the local government level. And I just fell head over heels in love with local government. If you talk to me for more than 5 minutes, you're going to hear me talk about parks, the counties, the cities, and all the work that's happening there. I ended up running for local office for my local parks board in 2017, falling in even deeper love with local policy work. And as a direct result, I built these new set of skills and realized just how amazing policy work is and empowering my peers to know like how the nonprofit sector can influence policymakers and policy writing. I did some policy work at a healthcare organization, and then currently I've been in at the Northwest Health Foundation doing policy work within philanthropy, which is very fun.
Yeah, very interesting. So now that you've shared how you got where you are, or I know it's a real snapshot, but tell us briefly about each of your organizations and your roles in them.
Yeah, so I'll start. I'm the director of advocacy at Latino Network. Latino Network is a bit of a mid-sized organization, getting bigger. We're about 200 employees. We're running programs at about 48 different schools in 9 different school districts. We work across the Tri-County area here in Portland, Oregon. We're providing services across social determinants of health, employment support, housing, education, education access support, college readiness, reentry and diversion services for youth who are involved in the legal system, as well as some adult work in the legal system, immigration services, leadership development, and then health and wellness with our community health workers, actually training other people to be community health workers. We are now state certified to provide that training and certification in Spanish. And so we're continuing to grow our reach in the community. It's really about seeing the Latino community thriving, grounded in culture, and reaching our full potential. I personally, in my department, our advocacy department, I oversee the leadership programs, and they're really pretty expansive. We've got from middle school, high school, early career professionals, mid-career professional leadership programs, and then our immigration services work. And my work specifically is around community engagement, government relations, and systems change, knowing that doing direct service is only a portion of how we meet our mission. Changing the systems that have perpetuated harm in our communities is also a very large part of the work as well. In addition to my paid work, I'm also on the board of the Nonprofit Association of Oregon, as we discussed, and the Housing Development Center and Northwest Instituto Latino. And I love being able to spend my time from 9 to 5 and 5 to 9 doing this work in my community.
Well, 3 boards. It's a huge commitment, I'm sure. Thank you for sharing that. How about you, Felicita?
So I am the public affairs manager at Northwest Health Foundation, and we work to promote, advance, and support health in Oregon and Southwest Washington. In particular, we support BIPOC-led organizations to engage in policy work and build political power. This is partially because we are a C4 and we want to make the best use of our resources, but we also know that systemic racism is the root of these health outcomes that we're seeing in our BIPOC communities. And we know that when we have BIPOC communities at decision-making tables, they will make decisions that are best for their communities and ensure they lead healthy lives. And I have the absolute pleasure and honor to deeply engage in policy work with these community members and leaders, invest in them and the amazing work that they do every day, whether it's ballot measures, candidate work, bills, and I also lead our communications work.
Yeah, that's a lot as well. Important work. Thank you. Mercedes, you shared with me in our initial conversation what motivated you to get involved in the issues of nonprofit working conditions based on your own experience in the sector. Would you mind sharing that with our audience?
You know, for a long time, probably only as recent as my, not this current job, but the last job, where the first time was I was really starting to get to the point where I no longer qualified for the services my organization was providing, right? When you think about how low some of the wages are for nonprofit employees, they're working in communities trying to do great service, making money that is not always sustainable and really puts a lot of pressure on people to try to do too much sometimes. I do think it's just completely unacceptable that even today we have people working in shelter who would qualify for affordable housing programs, right? And we're not investing that level of stability in the workforce itself, which is also why we tend to see too much turnover. This is passion work for people, but people still need to put food on their tables and have stable housing of their own. One thing that comes to mind a lot is actually doing my master's program I learned a lot about generally the history of the nonprofit sector, and that for a long time it was called the voluntary sector, that this was a space where it was expected that this was work of middle-class white women who did not need income. And as the work has evolved over time to really be about community reinvesting in itself, we haven't seen the investment necessarily take the professionalization seriously, to the point where we're still now in this weird place where we're expecting people to have, you know, degrees, master's degrees, licenses, and we're still not seeing those wages keep up. It feels endemic in some parts of our sector as well, the expectations of how much work we're putting on people with such stagnant pay. I also thought about, you know, preparing for this. When I was in AmeriCorps, you know, everyone in our sector knows what AmeriCorps is. It's a great program. We utilize it a lot. It doesn't pay folks very much to do that program. And as a young 20-year-old, I guess I didn't do my taxes right. Didn't even realize I was paying taxes on my AmeriCorps stipend. And then ended up having my wages garnished for almost a year to pay that back. So in appreciation for my service to my community, I ended up being garnished by the IRS. And like that kind of thing is wild to me, that we're doing that to people who are willing to take on the hard work of caring for each other. At the end of the day, government is a jobs program, right? Whatever the government's putting its money into is what's building employment in our society. And so why not invest as much as possible in jobs to support people in caring for each other? This is how we create a sustainable investment in the community of care, where we are just supporting each other. We're trying to do best by each other. And I really think we need to get away from a mindset of like helping people too much, which feels like something that happens a lot in our conversations. But we should have really good working conditions. These kind of jobs should be things that people strive to participate in. I know that's why I got into this in the first place. I wanted to be those great people who were taking care of my community. I wanted to be like them. And it should be easy to have jobs like that, at least in a financial way, because the work is hard, right? One of the things I like to say at work a lot is, like, this is really hard work. So it can't be hard to come to work. We need to make it easy for people to have these jobs for the long term.
Right. Absolutely. We definitely need your voice out there sharing that message, because you said it beautifully. I'm also an AmeriCorps alum. And we actually had on this show Michael Smith, the CEO of AmeriCorps, at the beginning of season 4, our previous season, in a bonus episode. And we asked him about the livability of the stipends for AmeriCorps. And he talked about how he's striving to increase the dollar amounts in those stipends, as well as in the education awards that are provided to AmeriCorps members upon completion of their service. But we did not talk about the tax issues that people may face. So, your wages garnished means the IRS took a chunk of your wages away to make up for those taxes. Is that what that means?
Yep. Directly out of my paycheck. They didn't ask permission at all. And AmeriCorps wasn't even my only job, right? Like, because it wasn't enough to live on. So I was doing that while I was also working evenings and weekends at a local bookstore and doing some work study on top of that. So it's one of those things where I was flabbergasted when I got that letter in the mail.
Wow. I'm pleased to introduce our season 6 sponsor, Loftus Partners. Are you frustrated with a lack of progress on equitable pay in your organization? Look no further than Loftus Partners, your go-to source for human resources consulting with a unique twist. Loftus Partners is not just a consulting firm. They are a 100% woman-owned powerhouse at the intersection of HR, organizational development, and social justice, with a focus on nonprofits. They've launched the Pay Equity Collective, a peer learning experience that provides capacity building, strategic resources, and a supportive community for nonprofits seeking pathways to pay equity. Visit payequitycollective.com to learn more. Loftus Partners, empowering organizations and advancing equity one collective step at a time. All right, Felicita, you want to share about how you came to be passionate about these issues?
You know, everything Mercedes said. I kind of love following Mercedes because I could just say everything she said. For me personally, this is a sector that is so profoundly undervalued and under-resourced. You look at data, it's about 73% women is a report I saw for the White House in this sector. We see job postings that need a master's, that need language skills, that need evenings and weekends that pay minimum wage, right? This isn't sustainable for a sector that so many of us are dependent upon and our society is dependent upon. So for me personally, this is an excellent use of my 9-to-5 because these are people who are amazing, making the world a better place, that deserve sustainable wages and a job that they want to go to every day. For us as an organization, it all ties to wages and turnover. We see a significant connection between how government contracts are working and the number of government contracts that are grantees, as well as the entire sector is engaging in with local, state, county governments. And for us, it all connects. You know, these are essential partnerships that these jurisdictions are dependent upon, but they are not treated that way. In what other sector would you wait a year to be paid? In what other sector would it be okay for the government to tell you, well, these are what the wages are capped at for your outreach staffer? The government is so dependent upon these organizations to do the critical services that the government needs to meet their goals, right? Whether it's homelessness, education outreach, and we have to treat the sector as valuable as they are. We have to ensure that they are sustainable, and engaging in this work and ensuring that is like such a pleasure and an honor and a great use of foundations and philanthropy's time.
Well, on that point, that it is a good use of time for funders and associations in our field to address these workforce issues, let's share the story of what you all have been doing. So my understanding is in early 2022, but almost 2 years ago, your organizations began working to reform how Oregon treats nonprofits and nonprofit workers. So talk a little bit about why, and you've set us up well for this. Why did each of your organizations undertake this work, which a lot of funders and associations don't address these issues? There's fear. We don't know if we can do advocacy. This is not our priority issue. Why did your organizations decide to take this on?
So, you know, for us, everything that you just shared, you know, there was a joint agreement on what the problem was, that there was frustration and practices that were not ensuring that the nonprofit sector was sustainable or even feeling like they were a respected, valued partner. At Northwest Health Foundation, we felt strongly that there was a legislative fix to this. We knew that hundreds of organizations were currently contracting with the state and not having a positive experience. Whether it was low administrative reimbursements, caps on wages. As a foundation, we have been engaging in legislative policy work for years, predominantly focused on democracy bills based on our values and based on the grantees that we engage with. But this was an opportunity to, one, partner with the Nonprofit Association of Oregon, as well as not just do work that would directly benefit our grantees, but the entire sector that we were seeing hurting so bad as a direct result of some of these practices that were happening with the government.
How about you, Mercedes?
I mean, for me, it ended up being a little bit twofold, right? Because it was part of my role on the board of the Nonprofit Association of Oregon, as well as my work at Latino Network. And for NAO, it started to feel like a really good moment to try to lean into a statewide strategy because we had started seeing some local organizing with organizations and kind of specific subsectors, particularly homelessness and human services, trying to address their county contracts. And so there was more and more work starting to spin up, more and more attention, ideas for solutions. And NAO was kind of being called into that discussion. So it wasn't just NAO like leading it. It was NAO also being responsive to what was already happening on the ground in more local communities and trying to figure out how to take that to the next jurisdiction up to affect more nonprofits. And then for Latino Network, at the time and still now, we're in a significant point of growth. In 2018, the organization was probably about 50 people. I think I mentioned like today we're at 200. So it's been a lot of growth in a short period of time. a lot of it driven by COVID, right? A lot of it driven by this urgency of like, go faster and do more. And as many organizations were during that time, we stepped up to that plate and we said, we can do more and we can go faster. But also that had a shelf life too, that if we wanted to continue to invest and see outcomes at the level that we were trying to see them, it was not going to be sustainable with the current structure of our partnerships. That if we wanted to continue to have these shared goals and really accomplish healing and support in our communities, then we needed to fundamentally shift how we treated each other. The government was getting way too transactional with the way that they were trying to engage with us, saying, we need you to do this in the next 6 months, and then we'll pay you sometime in the next 12 months. And when it was the height of COVID, I think everybody was willing to stretch as far as possible to make that happen. As we started to get more of a handle on things, as things started to feel more under control, it gave us time to kind of come up for air and say, these regulatory and financial systems that you have set up are not things that can continue to go forward. There has to be a shift in the kind of respect you're giving our organizations on the work that we're doing and the kind of stability that we're putting into these contracts so that we're still getting those good outcomes.
So walk us through how you all got started. How did the collaboration evolve between the foundation and the nonprofit association and other groups? Go ahead, Mercedes, why don't you kick this off?
I think one of the great things for NAO and how this collaboration evolved was actually NAO hired a policy director. So for a long time, you know, we're doing a lot of stuff through committees and like board engagement. It was a lot of capacity building for organizations, learning their own skills on how to build their nonprofit. But bringing in a policy director at the time when this collaboration was beginning, I think gave it a new sense of energy. And then as the work continued to evolve, NAO was speaking to organizations, pulling additional organizations in to be part of the campaign team so that it wasn't just NAO as a representative of the sector, but we also had individual organizations who were able to bring their perspective. And then that also continued to grow with the campaign team and the new policy director, then going to the full membership and bringing this larger coalition of people to sign on to the bill, start bringing their stories forward too of how low indirect rates, low wage caps, complicated applications, complicated contract terms were really impeding their ability to focus on the work because they were spending so much time on this compliance and these insufficient funds trying to find other funds to backfill them, right? To subsidize the government. Mm-hmm. So those organizations started coming in really strong with their stories as well. And we were able to then support, you know, series of meetings with elected officials. And it brought this strong communication, this strong sense of confidence that like we as a sector can stand together on an issue that is about us. Because we oftentimes want to show up for the things that are really about our community. But this was a time to show up for something that was about us and what we needed as organizations to be supporting our community. And really pulling forward, I think, a great solution-oriented mindset. I mean, we have a ton of organizations that have their own ideas of like how this could be fixed, conversations they've had in national conferences with other organizations who are also trying things. You know, we're not necessarily reinventing the wheel here. We're just trying to bring together to have that cohesive communication, that strong sense of confidence that brings us together, and really remaining solution-oriented in that mindset.
I'll just add that what really helped these two organizations work well together and reach several of our goals was that we both brought a unique set of resources. So NAO has over 1,000 members, right? And a deep, thoughtful reach in the state of Oregon. We have about 80 grantees. Not to say that we don't have a deep, thoughtful reach throughout our service area, but it's a different scale, right? We also, at Northwest Health Foundation, we have two contract lobbyists that we have worked with for years that we could add as capacity to this type of effort. And so together, we just had sort of a dream team that could ultimately pass a bill that we were excited about because this work is not easy. There are ups and downs. There are changes. While it didn't go maybe as smoothly as we all hoped, there were certainly wins throughout the process.
Great. Tell us what you did then with the capacity and the confidence and the communications and the lobbyists and the stakeholders that you all brought together, the members and the grantees. What did you do to get legislation created because I'm curious, like, who writes the bill? How do you work with the legislators to craft the actual legislative language and ideas? And then how did you get it introduced into the state legislature?
Yeah, these are all great essential questions. And I'll quickly add that for any foundation, philanthropic organization listening, I think it's easy to be like, oh, Northwest Health Foundation is a C4, so they can just do whatever they want. Almost all of what I'll talk about is C3 eligible work. You know, having a relationship with a legislator is not lobbying. Telling a legislator what you're hearing from your grantees is not lobbying. That's just stating facts. So a lot of what I'm going to talk about is C3 eligible work that I hope foundations and philanthropic organizations will engage in, because it makes a really big difference. And nonprofits need someone else yelling from the megaphone about what these problems are. So writing a bill, you know, there's a whole process. Like I said, we have two wonderful contract lobbyists that we've worked with for years. They helped us and the coalition understand exactly what needed to be done to get to a bill that passed. You know, we were all in agreement about what the problem was. That was very clear. Lots of whiteboards, lots of discussion about no shortage of issues. But there were two things that kind of needed to happen simultaneously. So one, we needed to find sponsors for the bill, and then we needed to write a bill. So I'll share that our lead sponsor, it was important to us that we find someone that understood what the sector was facing. And so we reached out to Senator Winsvae Campos, who represents the suburbs of Portland and happens to have a nonprofit background. And she was excited to be the lead sponsor of this bill, which was fantastic. And we so appreciate her and her leadership. At the same time, we were writing a bill. In, you know, the dream scenario, it would be one that we could all agree upon. In our original bill, it really had everything. It had a $40 million fund that would work to address some of the issues that we were seeing in our sector. It had minimum requirements of 10% indirect rates. It had a 30-day requirement for payments. That was a big thing that kept happening, right? For some contracted organizations, it takes 6 months, a year, over a year to get paid. And that just doesn't help with the financial stability of an organization. So we had what we thought was very low-hanging fruit, as well as we wanted a long-term solution that would work to address some of the issues and talk about the issues and come up with solutions. So we had this vision of a task force that would, as a few of these pieces pass, they would then look at, okay, what are the other fixes that need to be made? What are changes that can happen to ensure a more positive experience for everyone to meet these critical needs in the community?
So before we talk about what happened with the bill, can you share what was the idea for that $40 million fund in the legislation? What was the concept for what that would do, be used for?
So the vision was that we have nonprofits that are hurting financially as a direct result of years, decades of poor contracting and grant-making practices from the state and others. And so the vision was that this would be a grant fund that the state potentially would manage, and organizations could apply to get some general operating funds to address some of the issues they were seeing. We wanted, in our dream scenario, for it to be as broad as possible so that an organization could say, you know what, if I can support my staff in working from home, that's going to help with some of the turnover issues we're seeing. If I want to invest in my staff in some professional development, I think that's going to address some of the issues that we're seeing. So as we see in philanthropy, you know, more gen ops, more openness to what is being funded, less sense of control. Right. And that was certainly the intention with this fund. I think that was also a concern to some legislators of just how broad it was. Mm. And ultimately, that piece of the bill had to be removed. Mm.
It does make a lot of sense. I mean, all the issues you're raising, I've heard in, you know, in other states, in counties, the same issues with government funding and contracting.
I didn't even mention that this $40 million, this fund that people could use to increase wages or give bonuses to, right? Because wages are one of the biggest issues impacting our nonprofit leaders. Like, let's ensure they can access some funds to address that, increase wages by a small percentage, give a bonus. And again, unfortunately, this piece didn't pass. You know, we'll continue to bring up these items because it is one solution to a multi-pronged issue.
Right. Okay. So the legislation itself did pass in June 2023. You've told us that the $40 million fund was removed from the legislation, but what else happened? What did it look like when it passed? Mercedes, you want to take this one?
Yeah, I'll jump in. So a lot of it got really scaled down. It really got scaled down to just the task force. Mm. I think what we learned was that we had convinced everybody that there was a problem, which is actually fairly impressive in my opinion, because most bills, at least in my experience, the first year they're introduced, they don't pass at all. Right. So the fact that we were able to introduce something and it was still passed that first year, again, although a scaled down version, but it maintained the intent of saying, like, a new normal is coming. We are not going to keep doing things this way anymore. So we learned that, I think, in our conversations with legislators, that they agreed there was a problem that had to be solved, that this problem was not something that was going to be solved on its own through individual organizations negotiating with their individual contract managers, and that there needed to be something at a higher level reviewing the practices across departments and agencies to be making solid recommendations for solutions. So we thought we had some solutions on the table, right? Like the 10% de minimis rate, the 30 days to payment. We kind of saw those as solutions to the problems we were identifying. So we didn't necessarily convince everybody that those were the solutions, but those are still the things that are going to be on the table for the task force to be discussing. Because from the, I think, nonprofit provider's perspective, those are very much the low-hanging fruit. Those are very much the easy things that we could be doing. In addition to the more complicated things like a universal application, for example, that really reorganizes how the government is doing procurement with their nonprofit partners. So I think we made the most significant step forward, which is essentially broad agreement that there was a problem to be solved and that this problem needed to be solved at a level that was across government departments and not just kind of like one funding source at a time.
Right. What would you say, what was the resistance or pushback on, for example, the 10% minimum indirect cost rate or the 30-day payment standard? Was it just that the government feels like it's not ready to make those changes sort of procedurally, or did they think that was a bad idea, or they just didn't understand? Like, why did those not happen, do you think? Go ahead, Mercedes.
Ironically, it was because they thought they couldn't afford it, right? Like, they couldn't really do a good financial analysis to even figure out how many contracts and how many departments were paying below the de minimis rate, which again is federal guidance that they should be doing that. So they couldn't even calculate how much that would change the existing budget. The 30-day, like, huge confusion with, like, well, our accounting systems, we'd have to upend our whole accounting system to be able to meet that. Even though that language exists in most of the contracts already, they started to realize how much the nonprofit sector was floating the government, and that to do right by their own bills would be really expensive and really complicated to essentially follow their own rules. And I think we had to, on our side, recognize that if we want these things, we do need those structures to change. And I think that's one of the more difficult things for government to do. Government entities are much more comfortable providing oversight for other people's work, right? Maintaining compliance for work that they want to see done. Having to look internally to adjust their own systems is a lot more complicated. And since they couldn't even come up with a price tag on what that would cost or what the steps would be, I think that that's what slowed them down from being able to see these as low-hanging fruit in the way that we did.
Can I just add that it's clear that there's no consistent practices across departments and even sub-departments. It's so confusing for the grantee, but it's also really confusing for the grant maker. This is something that I hope will be discussed further, but I think legislators are starting to understand and is something we need to work on.
Yeah, there was this study in California that found that within foundations, one program officer might be setting one overhead or indirect cost rate down the hall from another program officer setting another indirect or overhead rate. And so it sounds like it's the same in government, where it's all over the map and it's confusing for them. There's no consistency. And it's confusing for all the nonprofits that are trying to work with government through these grants or contracts.
Exactly. And NAO did this great report that I hope you'll put in the show notes, focus on government contracting practices and interviewing or doing a survey of nonprofits across the state. And in the top three, over 70% of respondents, you know, two of them were about the amount of money received, the wages. But then the third was focused on the application processes, how difficult they are. You know, these are folks that want to be out in the community doing amazing work, and they're spending half a day on reporting or half a day trying to track down information that no one will read. And so this is not sustainable. This is not a thoughtful use of such valuable time. So it's got to change. And that's what we're working on.
Right. So you're still working at it. So tell us what's happened since the passage of the law, which established this task force.
Yes, we aren't done. You know, we definitely see this as a multi-year project. So the task force piece of the bill passed. It just so happens that Mercedes and I were recently named as members of the task force, as well as several other foundation and nonprofit leaders. Moving forward, Nonprofit Association is hosting these wonderful policy labs that talk about what other states are doing, what other communities are doing to address this issue. They recently had Maryland in, which was fascinating because they have this whole uniform application process for their state government. They said it has saved them hundreds of millions of dollars. So I was super impressed to learn about that. And, you know, we're all dreaming about what could we do? And this is not a unique Oregon problem. Every state is facing this. Every jurisdiction is facing this, and nonprofits are getting riled up and using their voice. And so these policy labs allow us to learn about what's happening in other communities and steal other great ideas, and feel free to steal our great ideas as well. For me at the Northwest Health Foundation, I'm really focused on making sure my peers in philanthropy are up to date on what the task force is talking about. I want to make sure that if there's an opportunity to give public testimony, that they come and use their voice and share what they're hearing from their grantees. You know, there's several of them have been approached about bridge funding while they wait for government payment. As you can imagine, that isn't terribly exciting to foundations. Some are very uncomfortable with it. Some are trying to make it happen. But I don't think that's a fair solution to late payments. I would rather the government work to fix this issue than foundations pay. And I want to be clear, though, I'm so appreciative of foundations stepping up and doing that, but I'd rather go fix the problem than have them try to fill the void. So this will continue to be, you know, a top issue for us at the foundation going into the 2024 short legislative session. I'll be keeping legislators up to date about what we're hearing from our grantees and other nonprofit partners, as well as the work of the task force.
Well, congratulations to both of you on being appointed to the task force. Before we continue, we should give a shout out to Allison Lugo Knapp, who helped project manage this whole campaign and who joined some of our initial conversations preparing for this, and who I know from her days with Emerging Practitioners in Philanthropy as a chapter leader when I worked there. So shout out to Allison.
We would not have been successful without Allison. She was fantastic, is fantastic.
She is fantastic. So, okay, now not only have you both been named to the task force, but Mercedes, you are chair of this newly formed Governor's Legislative Task Force for Modernizing Grant Funding and Contracting. Great name for the task force. I don't know what the acronym is, but we'll just call it the task force. Can you tell us about the task force mandate, the composition of the task force, and how you're steering this agenda going forward?
Yes. So our legislative scope of work is that we're going to be making recommendations to the Legislative Assembly and to the Department of Administrative Services. The Department of Administrative Services is kind of a bit of a hub for procurement in the state. So that's why they're kind of one of the targets of the recommendations. But the idea is that those recommendations would also then influence each department, because we're trying to work across a lot of departments here. So in the legislation itself, it kind of gave us a couple of real specific areas to take a look at. One was changes to the procurement practices that will support living wages for employees of nonprofits. So we're going to kind of dig into what is it that's in our current system that creates arbitrary caps or arbitrary limitations on what can be used for wages in that work. A uniform application process for grant monies, right? We want to see something that's much more consistent, that isn't just every single time there's a new dollar, there's a new process, but how do we get more consistent? We want to look at standard contracting language that also permits flexibility, but has some sort of consistent terms and conditions and includes also multi-year contracts. Again, we're not reinventing the wheel every single time. We don't have different agencies doing wildly different things, but try to find some consistency across the board. sufficient reporting requirements. We know that that's still an important part of the work that we do, but the reporting needs to be commensurate of funding levels. It needs to allow for adequate time in order to actually do that reporting. So we may need to right size those expectations between what the funding is and what the organization is being asked to do. We're also going to be looking at payment models that prioritize full cost recovery. So really trying to look at all of these ways in which we've set up expectations that you have to have matching funds, but it's not explicit matching funds, right? You're just like, I know I'm not going to get all the money I need. We'll see how underbilled it is, and then I'll try to figure it out someplace else. Really try to get rid of that practice and have more consistency that if what you want is 10 outreach workers, you're going to have to pay for 10 outreach workers, right? And get more consistent with that. And then looking at mechanisms for ongoing review and evaluation. Like, we don't want to have this be a one-time engagement where we're looking at these practices, but like, how do we set ourselves up so that as things change, as government needs change, community needs change, as the structure of nonprofits change, how do we continue to evolve together? One thing that is great about our task force, we have two legislators, non-voting members who are part of the task force. Senator Campos is one of those, and then Representative Conrad is the other, and it is bipartisan and bicameral. So we have House and Senate, and we have Republican and Democrat. We have 13 voting members overall. We've got government reps, philanthropy reps, and nonprofit reps. I'm glad to say that the nonprofits are actually the majority of the task force, which I think is really cool. And then we have nearly 20 other non-voting members who are just people in the departments. And so this is our youth authority, our health authority, our Department of Corrections, our human services departments, like basically anybody who is putting money out there specifically to work with nonprofits is going to have somebody at this table, including the Department of Justice, who, although don't do granting, tend to review everybody's RFPs, review all the contracts, and kind of are like an up or down approval of a lot of the work the departments are doing. So we get their perspective in early as well. So we don't try to change a bunch of things only to find out, oh, legally you can't do that, right? So really trying to set up these recommendations to be very actionable, very related to the real problems that we're having, things that can make permanent changes, and, you know, really moving ourselves past this one program, one funding source at a time, and looking at that kind of consistent community engagement and community investment. We just had a really big brainstorming session, so I want to make sure it's clear that I'm not driving the task force. The members are driving the task force agenda. And so it was a great brainstorming session. I can definitely say there was a lot to be said about, you know, why there's inconsistency in different parts of the process. We had, I think, one little sticky note that we had about, like, why do I have to give my proof of insurance to every single contract manager? Why don't you all like share that information with each other? I had to give it when I applied, and then I have to give it when I'm approved. I have to give it to two different people in the same department. And the number of sticky notes from the departments, for example, commenting on that, I was like, that's going to be a good meeting. So that was really our way of starting to kind of set the table for the discussions we're going to have over the next, you know, really like 8 to 10 months. You know, we were supposed to get these recommendations in more or less by September of 2024, get ourselves buttoned up by then so that we can start presenting this to the Legislative Assembly in anticipation for the 2025 session. And then also looking at if there's anything that the departments can start doing right away, right? We don't need legislative approval for everything we're going to ask for. So there'll be some things that we're going to ask the departments to really take a look at doing right away. And then there'll be things that need legislative action in order to allow for those changes.
That is awesome. So it sounds like you have a great group and a great set of stakeholders at the table, and that you're using that table to get everyone thinking. I just want to give a shout out to Danish Medora from the United Way of Columbia Willamette, who for a while was on our advisory council here at Fund the People when he was at Meyer Memorial Trust and led a lot of our work here at Fund the People. And I see that he's one of the nonprofit members of the task force.
And he was also on our campaign team.
Okay. So go Danish. And Helen Wong from Meyer Memorial Trust, I see as a foundation member, who's the person who told me about you all and this whole process. So thanks, Helen, for connecting us. So tell us, you know, how can listeners learn more about the new law and the work of the task force?
Yeah, we'd encourage people to, one, visit the Nonprofit Association of Oregon's website, and you can learn about the policy labs that are coming up, potentially watch some recordings, and you can see the reports that they've worked on. It's nonprofitoregon.org. The task force meetings are all very, very public, so you can watch them live, you can watch them recorded later, you can see our agenda, there's opportunities to give public testimony. In case there's something that you want to share as a local or you bring expertise in another area, we'd love to hear from you. So lots of ways to stay engaged.
And how can folks connect with each of you and your various organizations?
Feel free to send me an email. My email is listed on our website, which is northwesthealth.org. I love talking about what we did right and some of our lessons learned. I'd love to hear about what's happening in other communities. I have no shame in stealing other people's ideas and, you know, please steal ours. This is not just an Oregon issue, like I said. So let's work together, share the things that are working and the things that aren't. There's lots to learn from each other.
How about you, Mercedes?
I'm on LinkedIn. Feel free to make a connection with me. You can also email me at mercedes@latnet. That's also our organization's website, latnet.org. You can learn about our great work. And yeah, I mean, drop in at a task force meeting sometime. Tell us what you think. We have 15 minutes set aside for public comment. So far at the first meeting, nobody came for public comment. So it's an open amount of time right now. And definitely check out LatNet social media. We post a ton of great stories about the work that we're doing and ways for folks to get involved.
Great. Well, we will put links up to all the organizations discussed here and to the task force. And also we'll put up a link to our playlist on Spotify of episodes on this podcast that focus on the relationship between government and nonprofits, because we see this as a major thread of conversation on this show. We will add this episode to that playlist, but we've talked about these issues also in California and New York and nationally at the federal level. So we'll continue to cover this topic and track your wonderful progress and work in Oregon. Hopefully on this show, we'd love to have you back to hear more as your work evolves. Thank you so much for your leadership in the sector, and thank you for your time today.
Right back at you. Thanks, Rusty.
Yeah, thank you so much for having us and for covering this topic, and definitely wish a lot of luck to all the other organizations and associations that are out there who are trying to do right by their nonprofits too.
All right. I hope you enjoyed this conversation with Felicita and Mercedes. We still have a lot of work to do to get government leaders more informed about the role of our sector in serving their constituents and helping them understand how to build more productive, healthy funding relationships with nonprofits. The work happening in Oregon shows that modest-sized foundations, nonprofits, and the associations that represent them can effectively play a role toward making these changes. To hear more episodes about advocating for government contracting reform, just go to fundthepeople.org, click on podcast in the main menu, and when you scroll down the podcast page to the big blue box at the bottom of the page, click on the playlists tab. There you'll find a link directly to our Spotify playlist, including our collection of episodes on government nonprofit relations. Next week on the show, we're taking up the question, should we cancel capacity building as it is currently practiced in our sector? Melissa DeShields and Marcus Littles, two of the brilliant leaders of the consulting firm Frontline Solutions, asked this question in a provocative pair of essays in the Nonprofit Quarterly, and they'll be my guests on the podcast next week. So stay tuned for Melissa, Marcus, and more great guests right here on the Fund the People podcast. Thanks for listening to Fund the People podcast. Visit fundthepeople.org and click on podcast to find a transcript for this and other episodes and all the links discussed in the episode. If you enjoyed this episode, we'd really appreciate a 5-star rating and a quick review if possible on Apple Podcasts. it helps more people to find the show. Thank you for driving change in our communities. Remember to keep your tank full, take care of yourself, and take care of one another.